Spirit of life-giving love and love-giving life. Spirit of a world that is filled with beauty, that is filled with opportunity, that is filled with brokenness, and the religious impulse to heal what is broken. We gather together as one people, one planet, whole in spirit as nature, reaching to be whole in spirit in our hearts and in our minds. May we be fortified by our gathering together. May we see what lies ahead, that we may do what we are called to do. Let us hold this moment together in quiet. Amen.
Our first reading is the poem Nature by Transcendentalist philosopher and Unitarian scholar Henry David Thoreau. O nature, I do not aspire to be the highest in thy choir, to be a meteor in the sky or a comet that may range on high, only a zephyr that may blow among the reeds by the river low. Give me thy most privy place where to run my airy race. In some withdrawn on public mead, let me sigh upon a reed, or in the woods with leafy din, whisper at the still evening in. Some still work give me to do, only be it near you. For I'd rather be thy child and pupil in the forest wild than be the king of men elsewhere and most sovereign slave of care, to have one moment of thy dawn than share the city's year forlorn. Our second reading is an excerpt from the introduction to the essay Nature by the Transcendentalist philosopher and Unitarian scholar Ralph Waldo Emerson. Our age is retrospective. It builds the sepulchres of the fathers. It writes biographies, histories, and criticism. The foregoing generations beheld God and nature face to face, we through their eyes. Why should not we also enjoy an original relation to the universe? Why should not we have a poetry and philosophy of insight, not of tradition, and a religion by revelation to us and not the history of theirs? Embosomed for a season in nature whose floods of life stream around and through us and invite us by the powers they supply to action proportioned to nature, why should we grope among the dry bones of the past or put the living generation into masquerade out of its faded wardrobe? The sun shines today also. There is more wool and flax in the fields. There are new lands, new men, new thoughts. Let us demand our own works and laws and worship.
Thank you, Cheryl. You nailed Emerson. Not one easily nailed. So, February Focus Month has been a part of our annual program here for the past 17 years. We've used this opportunity to provide deeper exploration into some of the more formidable issues of the day over these years. The issues have included racism, peace and justice, sustainability, ethical eating, and homophobia, to name just a few. There are many, many more. And this year, our theme is of nature and spirit. For those of you who may not have been here during February Focus Month before, or for those of you who may not remember just how it works, here's the scoop. The worship services throughout the month are each designed to deal with various aspects of our theme, but they're all about that theme. The hope is, as Ralph Waldo Emerson suggested, the hope is to raise up the issues of our day so that they can be seen through the lens of our religious principles and our religious sensibilities, to the end that we might be transformed in our relationship to those issues of the day by our religious values. The purpose in maintaining a month-long focus is to promote an extensive examination of our topic in a way that can't be accomplished in any single week. It's also to promote the opportunity for a significant transformation in relationship to the theme. Our children are also exploring the theme of nature and spirit in their classes throughout the month. And as is our custom during Focus Month, beyond worship and religious education, be on notice that each committee, organization, covenant group, and council, the Board of Trustees, and all other groups in our congregation are asked to devote at least a portion of your time during this month to exploring your group's relationship to this theme. We hope that a similar exploration might even take place in the households of our members during the month. It may become a valuable experience for your family to have conversations around the supper table about of nature and spirit. Our mission here at the UUCM is to seek transformation in our hearts, our homes, our community, and our world. And as is usually the case with our focus themes, this one promotes an excellent opportunity to encourage every aspect of our mission. So our theme is of nature and spirit. For the first time in many years, there have only been maybe three years, we have not chosen a theme that is immediately and intentionally connected to any of the social action and outreach missions of our congregations. That's not to say that our theme this year isn't applicable to our Green Sanctuary Committee efforts or other expressions of justice that are connected to the topic of nature. It is to say that this year we'll be looking more toward how we are or can be spiritually connected to nature, to our world, in ways that are nurturing to us, in ways that enable us to experience a stronger sense of unity, a stronger sense of connection. And I trust that if we engage well enough, more pragmatic responses to our explorations will find their way into our thoughts and our visions and our actions, so that we might find ways of applying what we've discovered here to the world around us. So my hope for this morning is that we will establish our theme, first within the historical context of Unitarianism and Universalism, second within the context of even broader religious perspectives, and finally within the grandest context of all, a recognition that indeed we are the world. So first, we turn to our Unitarian and Universalist traditions. We've just heard the readings from the preeminent Unitarian forebears, Thoreau and Emerson. Both had much to say about nature and about our connections with it. I want to come back to their thoughts in just a moment, but first I'd like to add some flavor from our Universalist lineage by sharing some of the lines from Quillen Shinn's journal. Shinn was an evangelical Universalist minister in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, and his heart was on fire with the optimistic gospel of universal salvation for all. He traveled throughout New England and throughout many southern states, starting up Universalist congregations wherever he went. And in this journal entry that I want to share with you, you get a very good sense of how his religious fervor must have grown out of his love for nature and for life. This was written about an experience that he had somewhere between the years of 1870 and 1872. And he wrote, 12 years ago today, so he was writing now in the 1880s, 12 years ago today, I went maying for the first time as pastor of a Sunday school, went with the class, with the children. It was my school in Gaysville, Vermont, the best school I ever had, the brightest and the most active. The little picture in my study carries me back to that joyful day. It was taken on the street after we returned from our wild ramble, loaded with flowers, flowers in our hats and in our hands, our buttonholes and our belts, for we were crowned and garlanded, wreathed and decked with flowers and evergreens. Again, I scale the hills with them, romp on the green slopes, race through the sunny fields, scramble through the woods, then along the swollen brook to gain a crossing or quench our thirst, And while I'm helping Lottie and Aggie and Katie by the hand, the boys jump into or leap the stream and, refusing the proffered cup, lie down on the white pebbles to quaff the swirling liquid, fresh and sweet from the fountain. It was a golden day, he wrote. You get the sense of that experience? So Shin's comments are loaded with very loving connections to the children and to the time that he enjoyed with them in the very verdant hills of Vermont. He underscores the value in taking time out of our regular, hectic, demanding schedules in order to appreciate the nature that we are in the midst of, that we are nothing short of a part of. We can't do that if we don't remove ourselves from behind the barriers that we've constructed to defend ourselves from nature. Ironic, isn't it? We've so carefully protected ourselves from that which gives us some of our very best access to the divine, to the goddess nature herself. Shin's journal entry based on this Sunday outing with his church school class, romping in nature with great abandon, provides us with a connection that leads from nature to heart, or from heart to nature. It's impossible to determine the direction of that dynamic. It runs both ways. And it's just as impossible to imagine our existence here within the bounty of Mother Nature without some expression on our part of grand appreciation for it, some deep gratitude for that which brought us here into life and sustains us here in it. It's impossible, at least for me, to imagine being immersed in nature, free of barriers to it, as that fine day in May must have been, without experiencing a great rush of love in it and for it. Of course, that would be especially true on a beautiful spring day, yes? Maybe it would be a little less true on a cold, wet, rainy day, say, when the wind is blowing at 45 miles an hour or so. Hopefully, though, it would still be true at least somewhat, even on that day. To some extent, Thoreau and Emerson make less of an emotional connection to nature and more of an intellectual and philosophical and theological one. Still, their approach is one that is of exhilaration in response to nature. As leading transcendentalists of their age, they were on the cutting edge of an ancient theological thinking. And while the ideas were already thousands of years old, they were quite radical as they were spoken into the fire and brimstone Christian culture of 18th century Calvinist America. Emerson and Thoreau declared, despite the outraged response they received, they declared that the revelation of God to humanity was never sealed by the birth and death of Jesus 2,000 years earlier, as was proclaimed by contemporary Christian orthodoxy. Those Unitarian forebears of ours proclaim that God's revelation is continuous and that the vehicle for that revelation is nature. They held that the divine was not just an element of every aspect of creation, but that every element of creation is divine. There are many Unitarian Universalist theological connections with nature. Paganism, neo-paganism, and other earth-centered beliefs are an honored part of our lexicon. I cite Quillen Shin and Thoreau and Emerson as examples merely to make the point that our traditions have deep and historical roots in proclaiming and promoting our human connections with and within nature. We are hardly the only ones who have such connections, but we are ones who do have them. When we talk about our relationship to nature, we are talking about something that is authentically and centrally situated at the heart of our tradition. It's not something that's been stolen or borrowed from anyone else's. It's organic to who and what we are. It's our nature. A primary focus of Unitarian Universalism is more about our relationship with creation than it is with any particular view or relationship with a creator. Our relationship with creation is our relationship with nature. So moving on now and reaching out more broadly into the world of religions, we might look at a legacy provided to us by one of the world religions from which we are most closely descended, Christianity. At the Last Supper, which is celebrated by that tradition, we find one of the most profound moments in Western religious history. We find a most enduring connection between the impulse of religious longing and the answer to that longing as it's provided by nature. In any Orthodox understanding of the Last Supper, this connection might well be missed. But whatever else Jesus might have been, though, he was not Orthodox. And so we don't need to be confined by Orthodoxy either. To a significant extent, I believe Jesus was very much a humanist, like so many of us here. That's not to define what he may or may not have believed about the divine at all. It's more to say what he may well have believed or possibly did not believe about humanity. Why should we not enjoy an original relation to the universe, Emerson asked. And I ask, why should we not understand the teachings of Jesus in ways that provide meaning and direction in our lives? And so at the Last Supper, when Jesus held up the bread and said, "This is my body," it was not your run-of-the-mill hocus-pocus moment. He was saying something far more profound than abracadabra. He was saying, "I am this bread, and this bread is me." Some of you will remember that I often talk about this at our flower communion service in June. Jesus recognized, I trust, that in the same way that he was, so too was the bread a product of a very human and a very divine process. The seed of wheat is planted by human hands into the flesh of our Mother Earth. There it is warmed and moistened. The longing for life within that seed is tightly swaddled until it bursts open, sending shoots down into the earth and up into the sunlight to find nourishment and moisture. And finding them, the wheat grows to maturity, is harvested then by human hands. It's milled by human hands through stone wheels, turned to dough and kneaded, risen and shaped and baked until it finally emerges as bread. This is my body. It is touched by both the majesty of mystery and by the very ordinary human hands that bring it along its way at every stage of its journey. So when Jesus held up that bread and said, "This is my body," he was speaking for all of us. He was saying, "I am this bread just as you are this bread. We are the bread of life, and the bread of life is us. We too have come into being through processes that are both human and divine. That is our nature. That is nature. We are nature." Some of you may be familiar with David Foster Wallace, an award-winning American novelist, short story writer, and essayist. He died at a much too early age in 2008, but 3 years before that, he delivered an address to the Kenyon State University's graduating class of 2005. And in that address, he began by relating this story. There are these two fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming toward them from the opposite direction. And the older fish nods at the younger ones and says, "Morning, boys. How's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks to the other one and says, "What the hell is water?" And Foster Wallace goes on, "The point of the fish story is merely that the most obvious, important realities are often the ones that are the hardest to see and to talk about. Stated as an English sentence," he says, "this is just a banal platitude, but the fact is that in the day-to-day trenches of adult existence, banal platitudes can have a life or death importance, or so I wish to suggest to you on this dry and lovely morning," he said. To talk about our relationship with nature feels about as banal as fish talking about the water that they exist in. Foster Wallace got it right, though. To talk in banal platitudes may be what we need to do, have to do, in order to save our lives and to save the planet. The truth of it is, we are not alien visitors to this planet, no matter how hard we might try to convince ourselves of that. In all the universe, the stardust that gathered to form this planet formed it as one complete whole. It is the water that we swim in and the air that we breathe. It is the ground that we walk on and the creatures that we walk with, the plants that we eat and in turn eat us. It is our arms and our legs, our brains, and all of the tissues and the organs that make up our bodies. The truth is, we are not just of this world. We are the world. We have to ask ourselves, how has it come to pass that we have gotten so far out of touch and out of sync with the myriad aspects of who we are? We have to ask, how is it that we've come to see ourselves as being somehow separate, as being somehow above or over aspects of that which is our natural life? We have to ask, how is it that we've come to imagine that our human nature is somehow divorced from larger nature, somehow divorced from spirit, divorced from larger understandings of nature, divorced from that which holds us in life? The truth is, as we have drifted in our connections with nature, our connections to other parts of our world, we have indeed drifted in our awareness of ourselves and of our fullest nature. The truth is, the more removed we become from ourselves, the greater the peril that allows us to drift further and further away from that which holds and sustains us. The great mystery really does make it somehow possible for all of this, for all of us, to exist. Science may be able to help us understand how that works, but the great mystery will never be answered by science or by anything else. The mystery of the question why. That mystery is deserving of our respect and our participation. And unless our human hands and heads and hearts engage fully in the process of honoring and promoting life, we may well opt out of the very spiritual, very natural processes by which we are a part of the bread of life. How might we best engage in the integration of nature and spirit? Perhaps it is to invest ourselves in it. Perhaps it is to invest in banal platitudes that remind us of who and what and where we are. Perhaps it is to invest in time out, away from our regular hectic and demanding schedules, in order to feel the sun on our face and to feel the earth beneath our feet, in order to appreciate the beauty of nature that we are in the midst of, that we are a part of. Perhaps it is to invest our heads and our hearts and our hands and every part of ourselves in appreciation and expressions of gratitude, in the transformation of our lives through an awareness of our connections to and in all that is. Perhaps it is to invest ourselves in visions of the future. For if there is to be a future for humanity within the grand scope of nature, we will need to recognize that we here and now are the seeds of that future. The capacity to continue in the ongoing human and divine processes, which are a partnership we have in nature, hang in the balance. Indeed, it is true. We are the world. Our closing words this morning are from the former Congresswoman Pat Schroeder, who said, "There is an ancient Indian saying, we do not inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children." And she goes on, "If we use this ethic as a moral compass, then our rendezvous with reality can also become a rendezvous with opportunity."